Okay. Well, first, thanks for the invitation to come to Santa Barbara. It's very nice to be back here. What I'm going to talk about is work done in collaboration with Harvey Rial, who's a postdoc at Queen Mary College in London. And it's work that appeared last fall. So let me first start with some fairly basic things. One of the most remarkable results of what's sometimes called the golden age of black hole research is that it was learned that a black hole is the simplest macroscopic dynamical object that can exist. And this is the remarkable consequence of a number of theorems proved in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s by a number of people, which go by the way by the name of uniqueness theorems, and which state that a black hole, a vacuum stationary synthetically flat black hole, is completely specified if we give just two numbers, two quantities that can be determined by looking at the metric at infinity, which are the mass, its mass, and its spin. Right? And what this means is that the Kerr metric, which is the only solution that was first found describing a rotating object with horizon and, well, with rotation as well, this metric is unique in the sense that there's no other solution of the vacuum equations with these properties which has any other number that could distinguish it, or parameter that could distinguish it from the Kerr solution. Right? So one could think that in a sense black holes are, or black hole horizons are, like soap bubbles, in the sense that they are the simplest possible configurations which are compatible with constraints that we impose. Right? So this means that if the solution is going to be static, then it's going to settle down to a spherical configuration, and that's in fact the content of Israel's theorem. Now, when we put this soap bubble in motion, then everything is determined by, say, the tension of the bubble or the mass of the black hole and the spin that we're giving the black hole, right? And the theorem was also proven. It's not completely independent, but it's partly independent of this theorem, that black holes with topology, with horizons of topology other than spherical, cannot exist. This is, in fact, well, a proof to exclude things like toroidal horizons and so on, go by the name of topological censorship theorems, and it's been an issue of research even in the 90s. Right? But one of the assumptions that went usually unstated when formulating all these theorems were formulated very carefully, but if you read them, well, people never specified the assumption that the dimension of the space-time should be 4. Of course, the reason that people didn't state this assumption is that it seemed obvious at the time, but, well, maybe it's time to revise this assumption again. So, well, of course, people in this audience know that there are good reasons for studying dimensions other than 4. In fact, well, string theory gives us good reasons for going beyond 4 dimensions. And string theory, in fact, has had some remarkable successes in black holes, in understanding black holes, such as counting microstates. And there's been also a lot of work on classical aspects of black holes in string theory, and solutions describing p-brains, their intersections, and so on, have been found in recent years. But I think it's still fair to say that not much is known about the general properties of higher dimensional black holes besides what we already kind of extrapolate from what we know in 4 dimensions, right? And this is true not only for the quantum properties of black holes, but also for the classical black holes, and in particular for black holes in vacuum gravity, right? But there are reasons, and we have evidence, that going beyond 4 dimensions brings about several important differences. Well, first of all, one thing that's possible in higher dimensions, and it's not possible in 4 dimensions, is to have black strings, solutions with translationally invariant horizons and black brains. Right? But it's not only that these solutions are possible, it's also that the dynamics of these subjects seems to be quite complicated and quite rich. It was found several years ago by Gregory and Laflamme that these objects are unstable. They develop an instability by which they start oscillating. Well, people in this room have, in fact, made recent progress in analyzing the consequences of this instability. And it's been argued that this instability leads to new objects that were unsuspected a few months ago, in fact. And there are new solutions which describe lumpy strings, lumpy black strings, and lumpy black brains, which we could call inhomogeneous black strings, right? And I think that you've heard about this around here before. Some other things that are different in higher dimensions, change from going from four to higher dimensions, is, for example, in recent discussions about black hole production in TV gravity scenarios, people very often mention the Hoop conjecture. The Hoop conjecture was formulated by Thorn, and it states that a horizon forms if you can pass a hoop, which has a radius, essentially a circumference given by the size of the horizon radius. And the horizon is conjectured to form if and only if one can pass this hoop in all directions. But this is not true if we go to more than four dimensions, essentially because the mere existence of a black string rules out the implication in this sense, right? So we have horizons which are infinite in size. And in fact, there some of the solutions that I will talk about also provide could be taken to provide counterexamples to this conjecture, right? The conjecture in this direction is, well, it's plausibly true, but hasn't been, I don't think that it's, there's been much work on this direction, right? And some other things that we know that are different in higher dimensions, well, we've learned them from the solutions that were found by Rob Myers and Malcolm Perry in the mid-80s, where they found solutions which describe spinning black holes in higher dimensions, right? And these solutions, in many senses at least, well, they look like the four-dimensional Kerr black hole, but they also have some very different properties. For example, something that was already noticed by Myers and Perry is that if you have, well, in principle, in more than four dimensions, it's possible to have several independent angular momenta. And it was shown by Myers and Perry that in dimensions d larger or equal than six, there's no upper limit on the angular momentum that a black hole can carry. Right. In four dimensions, well, you know that this is the bound on the angular momentum that a Kerr black hole can carry. In five dimensions, there's a similar bound, but I'll be talking about this bound in more detail later. Right. So we have these differences. We also have, when one has more than one independent angular momentum, then, well, things get much more complicated and the dynamics are much richer, and still I think there's a lot of things to be understood in this respect. So we could ask ourselves a number of questions about black holes in higher dimensions to see whether the extrapolations from four dimensions are reasonable or not. First of all, can we have something like the uniqueness property of black holes in four dimensions? Since do the mass and the different angular momenta determine in a unique manner a black hole in more than four dimensions? In this sense, the question might be, are the Myers-Perry solutions the whole story? Another question that we may ask ourselves is whether there are possibilities for topologies different than spherical. Is there something like topological censorship, in the sense that the only topology allowed is for a horizon is spherical? And then another question that we may ask ourselves, since we, for example, we already know that some horizons in higher dimensions are unstable, we may ask ourselves whether the Myers-Perry black holes are stable as well, right? So these three questions are the ones that I'm going to be discussing along this seminar. And the questions will be addressed by using an explicit example that we have in five dimensions with a single angular momentum parameter, right? For the case of six or more dimensions, in fact, about the stability of these black holes. This is a work in progress with Rob Myers, and we hope to finish it sometime. So let me first review briefly the five-dimensional Myers-Perry black hole with a single angular momentum. The metric, well, I've written it down, so just you have an idea what it looks like. I've separated two bits. The first part looks very much like the four-dimensional Kerr solution, and then there's this part which gives us the fifth dimension. And what this part, which looks, as I said, like the four-dimensional Kerr solution, it differs from it in some powers of R, which are related to the different fall-off, essentially to the different fall-off of gravity in five dimensions relative to four dimensions, right? So horizons are determined by looking at the roots of this function. So when d equals 4, they were the roots of this quadratic equation. So this leads to the well-known inner and outer horizons for the Kerr black hole. In five dimensions, things are a little different because we have only one positive root. There's an extremality bound which comes from requiring that this mass parameter has to be larger than the rotation parameter. And this, in turn, when one writes this as a function of mass and spin, it gives a bound on what's the spin of the five-dimensional black hole. Right? Throughout this seminar, I will be using an abbreviation for this quantity, which I will call eta, and which is essentially, it measures the spin for a given mass. Right? So we have a bound on the spin for a given mass. And one thing that's different from Kerr, in Kerr, the extremal limit is regular. One can have a regular, the black hole that's spinning maximally is regular, even if its horizon is degenerate. But in this case, the black hole that, or the solution with maximal spin is singular. It's a naked singularity. So that's one first difference that we find in this case. In fact, if one studies black holes with spin close to the maximum possible one, one finds that these black holes are very much pancake. They are very much flattened, they are very distorted. In fact, the radius, if one measures the radius by computing the proper size of the circumference in this direction, one finds that in this limit, when eta, when the spin goes maximal, the radius diverges. Right? So this is quite different from what one has in four dimensions. In fact, this kind of suggests an instability. Such an object looks very much like an unstable object. Something that approaches a singularity doesn't look too good. In fact, well, one might even ask what happens to the third law. Even if the third law of black hole dynamics is the one that's worst understood, the fact that we don't have a regular limit for the zero temperature case is kind of, it could be worrisome.
The temperature still goes to zero, though?
Yes, I think so. I'm not sure, but I think so. I should check it. Yes, it does. I think so. Yes. So one could think, well, for example, what happens to an extremal rotating black hole in four dimensions? Say, what prevents it from, some, for example, from becoming unstable when you throw in particles that might violate this bound? Well, what happens in this case is quite simple. If you try to throw, say, a test particle into an extremal black hole in four dimensions, then you find that the impact parameter has to be sufficiently small, so if you want the particle to be swallowed by the black hole. If the spin of the particle is too large, if the angular momentum is too large, then the impact parameter is large enough that you miss the black hole. But this is something that apparently cannot happen for five-dimensional black holes, since the radius is so large and still the angular momentum is finite, it's bounded, then you might think that you might throw a particle to one of these rapidly spinning black holes, and then it might become over-extremal, and then you might run into trouble. This, well, if one looks at this in some detail, then one finds that this cannot be done in a quasi-stationary manner, because other one would be violating the second law. But in any case, even if it's difficult to make this more precise. This certainly looks like there might be trouble with these fastly rotating black holes.
So what happened?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about. Well, we have a conjecture for what happens. A conjecture, not a... Because what turns out is that the Myers-Briggs black hole is not the whole story. So there's a new object that we have found, and it is that in five dimensions it's possible to have a solution, an asymptotically flat solution of the vacuum Einstein equations, which describes an object in the shape of a ring with a regular horizon and which is rotating. Right? So this object has a horizon which has topology S1 cross S2. So these sections are two spheres. It's rotating, it's spinning. I've written down the metrics so you have an idea of what it looks like. It's not that I want you to go into the full details, but you can see that it's not a metric that's terribly complicated. There are no special functions, just polynomials. And you can very easily see what its features are. For example, from here, from the fact that you have a GT, G psi term, you see that it must be rotating in this direction. This is the psi angle. This bit here describes a sphere, a two sphere, where this coordinate x is like the cosine. This is the S1 part of the metric. This coordinate y is a bit like the radius. In fact, this solution, well, we found it, but we didn't build it. I mean, it was already there waiting for somebody to identify it in this way. In fact, it was written in a very, well, with just a few changes in signs, weak rotations, you could say, in a paper that I wrote with Andrew Chamlin a few years ago. In fact, this solution was just the electric version of a solution describing black holes accelerating in Kaluza-Klein theory. And this solution was found by Dauker and collaborators in 93, 94 or so. So, well, one thing that I may show you is what this coordinate system looks like. So you have a little bit more detailed idea of what it looks like. So we have this, as I said, this is the horizon where this radial coordinate describes a null surface that's rotating. These are surfaces of constant y, and these are surfaces of constant x. So this is kind of a coordinate that system that's appropriate for describing this ring-like object. This solution is characterized by a few parameters. First of all, we have two dimensionless parameters, this parameter psi1 and this parameter nu that enter into these two functions. Then there's a length scale, which in fact I'm calling it r because in the limit where this object is large, and then this approximates the radius of the ring. And if one, the metric as such has singularities, it contains conical singularities corresponding to the fact that we have to tune the parameters so the object stays in equilibrium, so the centrifugal force balances the tension and the gravitational self-attraction of the ring. Once one cancels these singularities, then one finds a relationship between these two parameters, and then one describes the ring. There are two possible ways of doing canceling these forces. One of them leads to the ring, and the other one, in fact, leads to the five-dimensional Myers-Briggs black hole. So it's a matter of how one chooses the parameters that one obtains. And this solution contains both the ring and the black hole. In fact, the connection to the black hole was already found in a slightly different manner in a paper that Fei, Gary, and collaborators found some years ago. Right. So, well, what this solution tells us is gives the answer to one of the questions that I raised before. That is that first non-spherical topologies are possible, right? So this we know by explicit example. Then, well, if we want to look into a bit more detail on the properties of these solutions, well, as I said, we have essentially, after we have imposed the regularity condition, the balance condition, we have one dimensionless parameter and then one length scale. In fact, the dimensionless parameter can be traded for another more physical dimensionless parameter, which is the parameter eta that I introduced before. So one could say that it's characterized by the ratio between spin mass and then the mass as a length scale. But this parameter can be taken to be something like a shape parameter characterizing the shape of the object. So when this parameter is small, one has a thin, skinny ring. When there's an upper limit for the value of this parameter, and then in this limit, when one approaches this limit, then this ring behaves very much like the like the black hole when it was close to extremity. It's very much flattened, it's very much distorted, there's a strong curvature, and it's very close to a singularity. Right? But what was more surprising to us when we studied this solution, when we started studying this solution, is that there's a minimum value for the spin that this object can carry if one wants to have a regular horizon. Right? So this is quite different from what one has for spherical black holes, where there's an upper bound on the spin. Here we have the opposite. We have a minimum bound for the spin. In fact, this is, if you plot what this shape parameter is versus this other parameter which measures the spin as a function of mass, then one finds a curve like this. So this means that there's a minimum for some shape of the ring, there's a minimum value of the spin that the ring can carry. Right? And one can find what's this minimum numerically, and it's slightly below 1. Right? One should notice, well, first of all, that it's a bit unusual to have a lower bound. One doesn't have an upper bound, so one can have this object carrying as much angular momentum as one wants. And this is not an extremal bound, so the solution that saturates this bound is not one that has degenerate horizons. Right? So it's
and there are a range of J and M's which have two
sanctions. Yeah, that's next transparency. Yeah. So, yeah, you guessed it. I mean, for this range of masses, there are two possible rings. And in fact, since the black hole has to have this parameter eta between 0 and 1, there's two rings and one black hole. So uniqueness goes through the window. Right? As you guessed, the ranges for the possible values of the spin and mass, they overlap. So we have that within this range, we have one spherical black hole, we have two rings, one of them is kind of more plump, and the other one is more pancake, and they have the same values of M and J. So we have an explicit example that in five dimensions, it's not possible to specify fully the solution by just giving these two numbers. These objects will differ, say, if you want, by measuring the dipole moments at infinity, the mass dipole moments at infinity, and well, you would say that even the topology is different between these two objects, right? So we have explicit counter example for uniqueness in this context. Well, stability is going to be two or three transparencies from now on. So, well, first, let's look at what's something like, what you could say, it's the thermodynamics of this black hole. So we will look at the area of these objects as a function of spin. So you fix the scale, you fix the mass, and then you study what's the area when you change the spin, right? So the plot that you find in this case, the following. And this dashed line is the area of the rotating spherical black hole, and this is the area of the ring. So we have this minimum possible spin for the rotating ring. Then we have this branch is the one that's where the black hole is very much pancaked and it approaches the singularity. And then, well, we have an arbitrarily large possibility for the spin of the black hole. So we have kind of interesting thermodynamics in this.
So you're saying setup. For fixed mass, you can have arbitrarily large area?
No.
Does that curve just go off?
Oh, well, yes. Well, if, no, for, fix, no, for fixed mass, the area goes to zero. I mean, this, well, this is not, it doesn't tend to, it tends to zero.
It tends to zero.
Yes. If you fix the mass, then you increase the spin, well, then the object grows very large, but also very thin.
So the area actually goes down.
The area goes down.
So it's all down.
Yes.
Yeah. You could also consider two black holes in orbit around each other. And I think they would have.
But that will radiate.
That will radiate, you said.
Yeah.
And this will not. This is.
Well, in principle, they are stationary solutions. They don't radiate.
They don't classically radiate. They don't classically
radiate. No, classically. Well, of course, Hawking radiation, that's another issue. But I'm just dealing with classical. Classical stuff. Right? So we have these three different ranges. We have that, well, for spin less than a certain value, we only have the black hole. But at a certain point, for some values of the spin, then the black rings enter the thermodynamic ensemble. And for some values of the spin, still, the area of the black hole is larger than the area of any of the rings. But at some point, at this point, we have the possibility of having two objects with the same mass, the same spin, and the same area, right? So it, this is kind of a point where this object becomes the dominant object in thermodynamics, and this, the black hole, becomes subdominant. So in this regime, we would think that we have something like global thermodynamical stability of the ring, and this, the ring should dominate the thermodynamics of, the, of this ensemble. Right. And what's curious about this is that this singular bit, this singular part, is hidden from the thermodynamical point of view. You would say that this is kind of smelling like a cosmic censorship, even if it's difficult to make it more precise. But this singularity is hidden from the thermodynamical point of view, right? And that's thanks to the existence of this solution.
So you'd say this is the answer to David's question. Try to spin up the black hole more.
Well, yeah, that's a conjecture that if you spin it up, then when you reach this point, then the stable phase might be this one. Of course, that's this is a thermodynamic statement. It's different from a classical evolution. I mean, that's much more. Yes, I think. Well. Well, yeah, you're changing the topology. Yeah, sure. Yeah. It can't be smooth if that's what you want. We've also studied the thermo. I mean, this is a microcanonical ensemble where you fix mass, you fix the energy, and you fix the spin. Maybe you want might want to study the ensemble where you fix the temperature and the angular velocity. We've studied this, but it's not particularly illuminating.
Is the temperature of the ring equal to the temperature
of the black hole at that point? Nope. No. It can be. I mean, you.
Which is higher?
I don't remember. I don't remember right now. I may have it in notes. Yes.
The observed black holes are rather close to one, aren't they? The ones in galactic cores?
But they are four dimensional, usually. Well, if they were five dimensional, then I mean that might be. Then we might call the astrophysicists. Okay, so now I come to the issue of stability, which is, as I said, it's much more difficult. Well, whenever, well, whoever has worked on the stability problem for the four-dimensional Kerr black hole knows that that's serious, really serious stuff, right? In fact, it's I don't think that the proof of the stability of the Kerr black hole has been completed. I mean, there's overwhelming evidence that the Kerr black hole is stable, but the proof hasn't been completed. And even for the Kerr-Newman black hole, I mean, even it's not been possible to even separate the equations and analyze them in any way that we would have liked. So, well, even then, we're able to say some things about the stability of these objects, right? So we have this object which is in the limit where it's very large and skinny, the limit where it's rotating very fast. Then this object is well approximated by a at least in sections, if we focus on a section of the of the black ring, then this is well approximated by a straight black string, and we know that they are unstable, and we know that they will we expect that they will generate bumps, that the lumps will appear. But in contrast to the solutions that you were discussing, these bumps will be rotating. In principle, we expect them to be rotating, and therefore they will have a change in quadrupole moment, and they will radiate away. Right. So we expect this. Yes.
So a month ago, right, at the Hawking test, we discussed this.
Yes.
So I was saying this, and
yes.
you were saying, but perhaps the boost, the rotation.
Yeah.
Would stabilize it.
It might help stabilize it. I mean, one can probably, I mean, we haven't done this yet. This is something we plan to do. To what extent the boost can, I mean, I think that the boost will switch off the instability for some value of the, for some values of the radius. I don't think that for large, well, in fact, in the limit where the...
So it might stabilize for the first modes
yes.
that are going unstable, but not the long wavelength.
Yes, yes, that's right. And probably, I think that, well, I'm fairly sure that very large rings are unstable. I don't know what happens at smaller values of the radius. Right? I think, my guess is that they will, that they might become stable at some point. There's another possibility as well, that the bumps don't rotate, that they are kind of riding along the, I mean, this is something that also was brought up at the, I think that you asked this question during Paul Townsend's seminar, because there are these super cheap solutions which keep their shape even if there's rotation. But they are different. They are different in that the balance of forces in the super tube is different from the balance of forces here. Right? I mean, this is a delicate issue. But I think that in this case, well, the instability will appear, the bumps will rotate, radiation will be produced, and then this parameter eta, the angular momentum will decrease, and we don't know when it will switch off. It may switch off when some stable ring configuration is reached, or it may not end, and maybe, well, it evolves into a spherical black hole. We don't know yet. I mean, this is a very delicate problem, and it's a quite difficult one. But there's also some interesting things that one can do, not in this limit of the large Skinner ring, but in the limit where the ring is close to the minimum possible spin. Right? So we had this ring, as we decrease its spin, there's some minimum possible value for the spin that it has. And then one might ask, well, suppose we have a ring that's sitting precisely there, and then we throw in some test particle which carries energy, but it doesn't carry angular momentum. This is easy. I mean, it's not like you're going to miss. You just have to aim at the center of the object, right? So this, the fact that you can aim at the ring at this minimum, this minimal spinning ring, and you can aim and you will hit it, and then it will swallow a particle with mass and without the spin, and there's no ring which can satisfy the, which can have both numbers the same as the object that you've constructed, then this suggests that these minimally spinning rings will also be unstable. Right? We don't know what the endpoint may be.
Isn't it obviously a black hole?
Yes, but then, well, if it's a black hole, I mean, do you think that there's a possible classical evolution from this object to a black hole? That there's, it's possible to change the topology of the horizon in a...
Well, I mean, two black holes in coalesce, that changes the topology of the
horizon. Yes.
Yes, I think that's right.
That's...
Topology can certainly change in that sense. Black holes can coalesce. You can't split a horizon. So
yes.
No bifurcation theorems. But there's
so,
no theorem that says you can't have this
okay.
sort of thing.
Okay, so well, yeah, that's... So you're saying that it's... You think that the transition in this direction can happen, but not in the other direction, from the hole to the ring? I mean, because this is something that we're puzzling about and...
I think from the ring to the black hole, it clearly can happen.
It can happen.
From the black hole to the ring, yeah, I think that cannot happen.
Now, this doesn't have to do with the definition of horizons being time asymmetric.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay, so then maybe we have an answer to this question, which is good. Well, in any case, well, is there? Well, one of the things that I should say is that this instability the mode responsible for this instability need not be the same as the mode responsible for the other instability. For example, in this case, we have the ring becoming lumpy. In this other case, the ring might, say, become elliptical or might have some other distorted shape. So it might also radiate away the angular momentum, right, by a change in quadrupole moment. So the question of whether there's some stability window for this ring, it hinges on the where these instabilities switch on and switch off. There might be a window for stability if this mode switches off before this one switches on. And it's not clear what will happen, but well, one could say that thermodynamics suggests that this instability of the slowly rotating rings might appear at around the place where the black hole becomes the black hole area and the black ring area become the same, right? So this is something that's suggested, but well, yes.
In the regular Planck case, it's possible to see the instability in two ways, but both by doing mode analysis and by comparing the entropy of the two with the entropy of like small
yes.
poles. I know that the secondary is kind of fishing
look
like what you yes. did. But I was wondering, did you try to like just take a bunch of black holes, spread in a ring and rotating and comparing?
Yeah.
And you make a comparison, maybe you get a lower entropy.
Yeah. Yeah, but as you say, it's not clear whether this is reliable. I mean, you can find two black holes flying apart, you start from one of these rings, then you construct another configuration which has the same mass, the same spin, but it consists of two black holes flying apart, and you compare the areas. Then you find that it's possible to have an instability for this ring when it becomes sufficiently large. But I'm not sure whether this is a reliable guide, right? So, well, as I said, the problem of stability is still open. It's the only one. But there are some other issues that remain open. And one of them is, well, suppose that you have one of these objects that's rotating with angular momentum in one direction, but it's possible to throw in some matter with spin in the other independent rotation plane. Is there any solution which has angular momentum in both directions? Well, we don't know, we haven't found, but it's a possibility, certainly a possibility that's still open. Are there some, well, for example, this is important for the issue of stability. Are there some solutions which describe objects like this and which are also supersymmetric? In fact, this is something that's one of the first things that one might think of. It's known that if you apply dualities and boosts and so on to the Myers-Pérez solution with a single rotation parameter, then you can end up with a supersymmetric five-dimensional rotating black hole. And this, in fact, was found by Breckenridge, Pitt, Myers, and Buff, I think. Right? So one might say, well, let's apply the same dualities to this ring solution. What one finds in this case is a supersymmetric solution, but it's singular, the horizon is singular, and it also has closed time-like curves everywhere. This, well, we've been analyzing together with Edward Teo, and well, it doesn't look too promising right now, but there may be more things that we're missing yet.
So this is starting with basically any parameter. You have a couple parameters in your.
You have the mass, and then at the end of the day, you take an extremal limit, and then you yes. Yeah, you start with a non-extremal one, you apply dualities and so on, and then in the end you take what people sometimes call the non-extremality parameter to zero, which is essentially the mass of the black hole that you started with, but after all the dualities it's traded into. One of the things that's curious about this supersymmetric singular ring is that it has momentum in both directions. Right? When you apply these dualities, you end up with a solution which has both momenta, both angular momenta activated. So another question that comes to one's mind is the issue of what happens in higher dimensions. One could think that this ring solution is something that you start with a black string, and then you just bend it. You take a very large string, and then you bend it, and then you form a ring out of it. Right? So this, you would think that this is the natural step in going from here to to there. So in higher dimensions, there are certainly more possibilities. You might think that you might have the same same thing for a size 6 dimensional black string. If you take a 6 dimensional black brain, there might be even more possibilities, and the farther you go in dimensions, then more possibilities that you get. It's not clear whether these solutions are possible. The topology of horizons, possible topologies of horizons in synthetically flat spaces, were studied for using the for the case of static configurations. There are theorems by Kai and Galloway which in 5 dimensions allow for solutions with this topology, even if they are static ones. Or at least the theorem was only proven for static ones. The one that we found is outside the domain of validity of the theorems, but it's also an example. But they couldn't extend their theorems to higher dimensions. Essentially, the problem is that the topology of 2-dimensional and 3-dimensional manifolds is very much well understood, but the topology of higher dimensional manifolds, it's a completely different kind of problem.
It's clear that such black holes should exist, right?
Is it?
If we take just standard extremal DP brain, right, we already have a sphere transverse to it. And then we can study a black hole when DP brain is near extremal. That corresponds to a field theory which lives in a flat space time. But we can consider this field theory compactified on the sphere and study that field theory at a finite temperature. And so you will end up having a black hole which would have
But that's of course, yeah. If it's not asymptotically flat, then you can do lots of things. Yeah, but the constraint of being asymptotically flat is extremely strong. Yes, that's what, in fact, what's new about these solutions, because we have solutions with horizons S2 cross S1, which are not asymptotically flat. You just take a black string and then you wrap it around the circle. But that's this we already knew. Right? Now, another thing that one might ask oneself is whether there's some generalized, and we've seen that uniqueness is not valid, but is there some version of uniqueness that's still useful in higher dimensions? Well, we don't know yet. One could also ask whether it's possible to have charged rings. It's possible, in fact. I found some charged ring solutions about a year ago, and we've also constructed some new charged ring solutions starting from the one that we already have. So, well, as I said, uniqueness theorems cannot be valid in any simple form, at least maybe in a more complicated form they might be possible. But in the failure of uniqueness in other contexts has also been found quite recently. As I said, asymptotic flatness is very much constraining. In Kaluza-Klein contexts, where you allow things to be wrapped around the circle, it's, in a sense, it's easier. At least we know of more examples where uniqueness is not valid. So you could say, I mean, one should first define what one means by uniqueness, but you could say that you fix the radius at infinity and you fix the mass in the reduced space-time sense, and then there are black hole solutions, there are black string solutions, there are inhomogeneous black strings. There are some other fancier solutions that we've Harry Rial and I have constructed, where one has black holes in the presence of Kaluza-Klein bubbles. One can even have several black holes in these space-times. So there are plenty of examples in these cases. And one of the interesting things about these solutions that you guys have been saying recently is that stability cannot be used in order to save uniqueness. Because one might say, well, for the solution that we had, maybe it's just one solution that's stable, and in that sense it's unique. But I think that you found cases where you have more than one solution and you've argued that they are stable. So it's not, stability cannot be used to save uniqueness in this context. And the last thing that I wanted to mention is that something that's an application of a different sort. It's a bit puzzling. It's something that's puzzled me for a while. this is, well, may this have to do something with the correspondence principle. Well, the correspondence principle, as you know, well, it was studied, it's been proposed for many years that there's some correspondence between massive string states and black holes, and that one can go in a kind of continuous manner, a diuretic manner, by changing the string coupling constant. And it's kind of ironic that the first hints that the massive string states might have something to do with black holes was the observation that I think it was made by Salam in the 75, that strings satisfy the same bound as the Kerr black holes. But now we know that this is just a coincidence, because this only holds for four-dimensional black holes. So this is, let's say, it's kind of ironic, right? That this was the first indication, and it was something that, well, we know of it just because by chance we happen to live in four dimensions.
Are the slopes the same, or are they different constants like alpha prime versus?
Well, the one of them has alpha prime, and the other one has the four-dimensional Newton's constant. Yes. I've hidden here. I've taken different units.
Yeah. But this comment also, I think, appears in Ring Towards the Width, right?
I mean, the connection between those two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, it's completely misleading because, yes, you know, in light of our work on the correspondence principle, we know that, you know, they scale differently with the string coupling.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's you have to, you know, match up the masses at the right, you know, coupling.
Yeah. And even then, I don't know if I haven't seen anywhere any detailed explanation of how rotating objects, how the correspondence works when one has rotation, right? And there's first the problem that, for example, well, the degeneracy as you approach the leading Regi trajectories, the degeneracy drop. And the extremal, well, you've probably thought about this, so I might be interested in hearing what you may have to say. But one of the things that might be interesting in this case is that, well, for strings, the spin is bounded. In more than five or more dimensions, the spin is unbounded, right? I mean, maybe there's the issue of using different units in each case, right? But we found that not only in six dimensions, but in all other dimensions, because in five dimensions you may have these rings with arbitrarily large angular momentum. So it may be that stability issues are necessary in order to establish this correspondence in the rotating case. The fact that an object that's rotating too fast, a black hole that, or a black ring that's rotating too fast, will become unstable, then this might be important in order to establish this correspondence. It's not that I have any solution to the problem, but this might be a piece in the necessary to solve this puzzle, right? And well, this is what I wanted to say, so I'll stop here.
So, just to comment about this last point.
Yes.
So, for four-dimensional black holes, the correspondence principle, as you know, can't compute factors like a quarter.
It yes.
Only get order of magnitude. So
yes.
Area. For a Kerr black hole, the only difference between a sort of maximally rotating
yes.
and a non-rotating
yes.
is a factor of four.
Yes.
So you don't expect to really be able to
yes.
distinguish that
yes.
for the ordinary.
Yes, that's good.
For higher dimensional black holes, Rob
yeah.
Myers and I did think at one point about
uh-huh.
how to reconcile this. And I can't remember what the idea was. We had some idea for how to sort of get around this.
I think, of course, that there might be a problem if you start with a five-dimensional or a higher-dimensional black hole that's spinning too fast. Then you decrease the string coupling, and then what sort of string state it evolves into, right? And that's not clear. I mean, and even if the topology, if you can have different topologies, then the problem might be even.
Well, there's a sort of earlier question.
Yes.
So if you take the higher-dimensional black hole,
yes.
what you want to do is decrease the coupling until the curvature of the horizon becomes of order of string scale.
Yes.
But now you have to decide whether you're asking about the curvature of the
yes.
pole or at the equator.
Yes.
They can be very different. And if you take one of them worked, actually. I don't remember whether it was the bigger one or the last one. We had something where it did actually give the right estimates
yeah.
for the density of states.
Yeah, it might be that that's not actually the issue, because, well, as I said, Rob and I have been studying the higher dimensional, fastly spinning black holes, and we have some kind of evidence that they become unstable once the, in fact, it's very soon, it seems like it's possible to these objects to become unstable once their spin becomes larger than the mass in Planck units, in a sense. Lovely. But that's still, I mean, this is one of, I think, an interesting problem that remains open.
Any more questions? If not, let's thank Roberto one more.